with an art professor at UW-Madison, some headlines from 55 years ago, and the most in-depth weather report on the airwaves.
So stay tuned, all those stories and more, but first we'll go live to London for news around the world from the BBC.
Hello, I'm Roisin Hasty with the BBC News. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights has told the BBC that Israel bears significant blame for the humanitarian situation in Gaza, where, in his words, starvation and famine are happening as we speak. Volker Turk said Israel had obligations as the occupying power and was putting up obstacles to the delivery of aid.
The report that was issued last Monday by the independent panel of experts identified famine as a very serious risk, with starvation starting from now until mid-May, if there isn't a massive humanitarian assistance coming into Gaza. So that brings up the question, with all the restrictions that we currently see, whether there is a plausible claim to be made that starvation is or may be used as a method of war.
The French Prime Minister, Gabriel Attal, has announced that the state will take legal action against the pupil whose allegations about her headmaster have led to death threats and his sudden resignation. Mr. Attal said a complaint will be filed against her for making false accusations. Hugh Schofield reports from Paris.
In late February, the head teacher at the lycée in eastern Paris stopped the girl to tell her to remove her Islamic head covering in accordance with French law. She refused, there was an altercation, and she accused the teacher of striking her. Shortly afterwards, death threats aimed at the head teacher began to circulate on the internet. And despite police protection, a few days ago, he decided to resign, citing concerns for his personal safety as the reason. There's been unanimous outrage among politicians in France. Police found no evidence that the teacher had struck the girl. And now the Prime Minister has stepped in to say that she's to be taken to court for making false allegations.
Investigators in the US city of Baltimore are examining the data recorder from the ship that brought down a bridge, killing six people. Inspectors are also looking at the twisted remains of the Francis Scott Key Bridge as they try to determine how and why the incident occurred. Divers searching for the bodies of the six missing construction workers have recovered two bodies that were trapped in a vehicle. Colonel Roland Butler is from Maryland State Police.
The victims were identified as Alejandro Hernandez Fuentes, 35 years old, of Baltimore, and Dorlin Raniel Castillo Cabrera, 26 years old, of Dundalk.
Argentina says it's hosting six members of the Venezuelan opposition at its embassy in Caracas. Local media say they are linked to the opposition leader Maria Corina Machado, who's been banned from running against President Nicolas Maduro in July's election. Venezuela's government is reported to have cut off power and water to the building. World News from the BBC. Haiti's presidential council has promised to restore public order and democracy in the country once it's installed, which is expected to happen in the next few days. In its first official statement, the council said it would appoint a new prime minister to organise presidential and congressional elections, which are long overdue. The council should have been empowered 2 weeks ago, but was delayed by disagreements between Haiti's rival political factions. A French court has reduced the life sentence of a Liberian former rebel, Kunti Kamara, to 30 years in prison for his role during Liberia's civil war 3 decades ago. At his first trial last year, he was found guilty of crimes against humanity and violence against civilians and given a life term, but appealed. Although the Paris Criminal Court reduced his sentence, it again found him guilty of the war crimes. Cambridge City Council in eastern England has ordered the removal of a controversial statue which was put up without planning permission 10 years ago. The statue, called the Don, was commissioned to commemorate the late Queen Elizabeth's husband, Prince Philip's time as Chancellor of Cambridge University. Here's Nornanji.
The 4-metre bronze figure, wearing academic robes and a mortarboard cap, is supposed to represent Prince Philip in his role as Chancellor of Cambridge University. But the City Council says the statue is unauthorised and that, because of its scale, height and prominent location, it has a harmful material impact on the appearance of the area. The company responsible for it, the Unex Group, hasn't responded to a request for comment. But unless an appeal is made, the Don's time on the streets of Cambridge will come to an end by August.
The former US senator and the Democratic vice presidential nominee, Joe Lieberman, has died. He was 82. Senator Lieberman was Al Gore's running mate in the 2000 election, becoming the first Jewish candidate on the national ticket of a major party. BBC News.
This is Marcus Slayton and Rob McClure with your local news, coming to you from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison. And here are tonight's headlines.
Three bills intended to shield the home addresses of judges are now law as part of more than two dozen bills signed into law by Governor Evers today. Two bills exempt judicial security plans from being obtained via open records and allow judicial candidates to request that their addresses be redacted from candidate paperwork. The third creates a misdemeanor crime for picketing, parading, or demonstrating at a judge's home. Those bills were passed in response to the 2022 killing of a Juneau County judge by a person he'd previously sentenced. Meanwhile, the governor signed a slew of other bills today on a wide slate of measures. One law ups the felony penalty for fleeing from a police officer. Another makes it a felony for owning, making, or selling lifelike child sex dolls. Other new laws create additional charges to the criminal justice system. One requires that correctional officers in prisons get training on symptoms of active psychosis. Another requires that victims receive notice before an offender is released. And another requires telecommunications providers to hand over location data to police in certain circumstances without a warrant.
A state police officer has been found not guilty of reckless endangerment after he fired twice at a stationary driver targeted by multiple law enforcement agencies 2 years ago. That's when nearly two dozen federal, state, and law enforcement officials descended on Quadron Wilson, surrounding him as part of a drug investigation. The raid left Wilson shot in the back with one bullet in multiple fragments, requiring multiple surgeries and hospital stays. Wilson was unarmed in that February 2022 raid. An investigation found that two DCI agents shot at Wilson. DCI agent Mark Wagner was charged with reckless endangerment for shooting at Wilson, while his DCI colleague Nathan Pesky was not charged and received immunity for testifying in his trial. Both maintained that they mistook Wilson's phone for a gun. Wagner testified this week that he thought he had been struck by gunfire. In making their decision, the jury was instructed to decide whether Wagner was aware that his actions would create an unreasonable and substantial risk of death or bodily harm. It did not take long for the Dane County jury to conclude that Wagner did not reach that threshold. The deliberation to acquit him lasted roughly 90 minutes, reports the Wisconsin State Journal.
Multiple news outlets have taken stock of our warm winter's impact on agricultural producers. Warm winter temperatures lead to apple trees blooming earlier than normal, according to the Capital Times. After the warmest February on record in Wisconsin, apple trees are expected to bloom early, which has apple growers growing nervous. This may mean higher prices for apple juice, applesauce, and pies for Wisconsin consumers down the line. Wisconsin is far from alone. This has been the warmest winter on record for the lower 48 states, according to the National Centers for Environmental Information. While the warm winter is partially attributable to this year's El Nino, the last 25 Wisconsin winters have all been warmer than they had been historically. In addition to apples, another tree-based product, maple syrup, is facing its own challenges. This time, reports Wisconsin Watch. The rising winter temperatures also mean an early start for collecting sap for making maple syrup, and the sap has started to run much sooner this year. The good news is that could mean a bigger harvest this year if you're ready for it. The challenge for maple syrup producers is that they've found themselves collecting sap 3 weeks or more earlier than normal, as the holes in the trees will close up in a few weeks. If people collecting sap don't quickly adjust to the shifting temperatures, they may miss out on some of the harvest.
The health consultant firm NuGen, located in Madison, today announced they are suing the Massachusetts-based investment firm MassMutual. NewGen is suing MassMutual for $3 million. It claims 300 employees have lost their retirement funds when MassMutual terminated a retirement fund in June of 2022. According to the Wisconsin State Journal, NewGen had informed MassMutual that they were planning a layoff of 110 employees. According to the lawsuit, MassMutual then announced a complete termination of the investment fund agreement, giving the participants access to the fund at market value, impacting nearly 300 employees.
The Wisconsin Latino Chamber of Commerce was awarded $5 million as part of the $1.2 trillion budget, yes, trillion-dollar budget, signed into law by President Biden on Saturday. While that funding is a small piece of the overall pie, it's a big step for the chamber's target of $15 million to pay for their plans for a 15,000-square-foot facility in Fitchburg. Named the Gateway, a space formerly occupied by a furniture store, the hope is to reshape the space into a, quote, one-stop shop, unquote, for local entrepreneurs. Renovation plans for the space include creating office and event spaces, adding kitchens for would-be restaurant owners to hone their skills, using the space to host markets, and providing business incubation resources like computer stations and co-working spaces. Future plans could also include adding a second floor and creating more space for food carts. Construction on the Gateway could begin by this December and is expected to be complete by the spring of 2026, reports the Capital Times.
And those were tonight's headlines. And now on to the rest of today's top stories.
A new report is providing a bird's eye view of Wisconsin's unhoused population following an increase in federal funding and a strategic shift. Our reporter David Ahrens has the details.
The Wisconsin Policy Forum, a nonpartisan research organization, published the report today. It tracks the state's unhoused population from 2014 to 2023. They found that from 2014 to 2021, Wisconsin's unhoused population fell by one-third. The report attributes that shift to a change in federal policy. In 2009, the U.S. Hearth Act ushered in a Housing First approach. Using Housing First programs place unhoused individuals in permanent housing as soon as possible, without prerequisites like sobriety or employment. And the outbreak of the pandemic in 2020 also brought on federal relief, which many municipalities use to fund this program and keep people off the streets. But those funds expire in 2024. And in the last 2 years, Wisconsin's unhoused population has started to rise again, a trend the Policy Forum attributes to increased housing prices. Dane County hasn't followed this statewide trend. In fact, the county's unhoused population has declined by about 25% in the last 2 years. That's in large part due to collaboration between provider groups and their focus on specific groups of unhoused people. Carla Thienes is the executive director of Porchlight Incorporated, an organization that provides housing transition services in Dane County. Porchlight also manages the county's largest man's shelter, located on Madison's Far East Side.
You know, we started with veterans, like really made a huge effort to collaborate together and reduce veterans' homelessness, and then we switched to families, and like the families saw a huge reduction.
The federal and local response to the pandemic helped avoid having mass homelessness as a result of the highest rates of unemployment in the state history. And the moratorium on eviction, along with rent supplements, kept thousands of people in their homes. But when that eviction moratorium ended in 2022, many renters either could or did not want to pay rent.
You know, there's a perfect storm. You know, obviously the moratorium and the running out of the rent funds, like eventually you're left with tenants who owe thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars. You're going to see landlords evicting people.
But the evictions in 2022 does not explain the continuing high number of people using shelters. Rising rent costs are likely one contributor. Median rent prices statewide increased by 27% in the last 2 years. Even though unemployment has subsided, the low-wage job sector does not provide enough income to keep up with rising costs. As a result, the number of people staying in Wisconsin shelters, like Porchlight, has exploded. What is also different from years past is that most of them are employed.
I've got a men's drop-in shelter full of men who are working and just cannot live in this town, right? They cannot afford rent. You know, the rising rents or just the straight lack of housing being built that's affordable for my clients. We're averaging 300 men a night, which pre-pandemic, 180 was the highest we'd seen for 40 years. And now I'm averaging 300.
And here's where the problem of availability or access comes in. Before the pandemic, all shelters had a limit of 90 nights per year per guest. As the pandemic went on, shelters realized that it was not practical and ended the limit. The number of people staying more nights, along with the increase in new guests, has created, some would argue, an unsustainable increase.
Starting January 1st, where we are at 850 unduplicated people that we've served so far. And if you don't have the layers of family and friends that you can stay with, you end up in a homeless shelter.
The report from the Policy Forum writes that the shift towards funding permanent housing is the most effective strategy for ending homelessness. But some Madison neighborhoods are resisting low-income housing development. At the same time, two major affordable housing projects in Madison, Rethke Terrace and Tree Lanes, are being shuttered. Perhaps the city government has learned that housing first does not mean housing only. Meanwhile, Dane County shelters are facing the end of pandemic relief funding.
The past 3 years, the majority of our funds to run our men's shelter have come from, you know, ARPA funds. I think it's just a huge wake-up call for everybody that these funds are gone, and the extra programming and services and things we were able to provide people will no longer be able to provide.
This is David Ahrens for WORT News.
March is Problem Gambling Awareness Month. Legalized sports betting isn't widespread in Wisconsin yet, but prevention groups caution that it's taking shape at certain locations, and laws in neighboring states are attracting bettors. Mike Moen of the Wisconsin News Connection has the story.
March Madness is in full swing, and depending on where you live, you might be able to place a bet on a college basketball tournament game. Wisconsin hasn't fully embraced the movement, but experts still advise people to avoid unhealthy habits. A 2018 U.S. Supreme Court ruling paved the way for states to decide if they want to legalize sports betting. That helped fuel the presence of online platforms where people can place wagers through their smartphones. Wisconsin limits live bets to tribal casinos, but bettors can flock to some neighboring states for online access. Rose Blazinski of the Wisconsin Council on Problem Gambling says they're neutral on these laws, but still have concerns.
We know that more people are going to do it, and we also know that more people are going to become addicted to gambling.
Since the legalization wave, Connecticut officials have reported a 200% increase in calls to gambling addiction hotlines. To protect yourself from falling into traps, prevention experts recommend only betting what you can afford. And if troubling patterns emerge, they suggest things like deleting betting apps and switching to flip phones. Nearly 40 states allow some form of sports betting, but some do have restrictions for college games. The financial impacts of problem gambling can be obvious, but Blazinski notes that compulsive gamblers also have a higher suicide rate. And with mobile betting marketed toward young adults, she says this demographic should be considered high risk.
They're at a time in their life where they're high risk takers to start, and gambling fits right in with that, especially the sports betting. It makes them feel important. If you're winning, you can brag to all your friends.
She says a big problem in helping young adults falling into addiction is that Gamblers Anonymous resources are outdated in the age groups they cater to. Industry leaders note their ads come with disclosures about problem gambling and where to seek help, but prevention experts say they're not easy to understand, and they call for more broader funding to carry out assistance programs. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
The time is now 6:20, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. The decide, next Tuesday, Dane County voters will decide who sits on the county board. District 12 represents Madison's northeast side, and two candidates are vying for the seat there, Sean Burke and Tommy Rylander. The current supervisor, Larry Palm, is not running for another term. Burke visited WORT's studios earlier this week to discuss his priorities with our news producer, Faye Parks.
Thank you for joining me, Sean.
Thank you very much for having me.
So to start, can you tell us a bit about yourself? What is your background and what inspired you to run for office?
I recently was a small business owner who lost his business because of COVID, and I'm currently the only candidate running for Dane County Board of Supervisors that's currently homeless or unhoused. I basically was priced out of the market after my landlord moved his daughter into my residence, and so I've been living in the 12th District for about 22 months in a hotel.
With that perspective, what are some of your priorities for District 12?
My main priority right now is affordable housing in all forms. Also, dealing with the increased homeless population. I think there's a lot more that can be done in that respect compared to other cities that have really made strides in reducing their homeless population. I also want to be dealing with the issues surrounding the F-35s at Truax and Dane County Regional Airport, and government accountability and transparency, because I think people need to know where their money's going and how it's being spent so that they know it's being spent wisely.
So going through those points, you first mentioned there are a couple of model cities that you would reference when it comes to handling people who are unhoused. Can you point to some of those?
Yes, recently the Capital Times came out with an article entitled Unhoused, and they referenced Hennepin County, Minnesota, which has a population twice that of Dane County. And in a two-year period, they were able to reduce their chronic homeless population by 36%. And it was a multi-prong approach. I have recently reached out to one of the commissioners up there just to inquire on how they went about doing that. Learning from other cities is probably the best thing we can do, because we may not know everything that they know. And so we need a multi-pronged approach, not just building more housing. We need to diversify our approach to how to handle affordable housing and homelessness in Dane County.
And you also mentioned the F-35s at Truax Airfield. Can you walk me through your perspective on that?
My perspective is very realistic. I know there are people in the district who adamantly oppose the F-35s there, and I completely respect their position. Unfortunately, as a county board supervisor, I am limited in what I can do, and I cannot make them go away. I wish I could, but it's not something that's in my power. What I can do is do what I plan on doing, is singularly focused on getting mitigating remedies for their homes, triple pane windows, noise canceling insulation, because those are really the only realistic items that we can do. I attended a community meeting on the F-35s, and I believe at first glance that the Air Force is doing everything they can to mitigate sounds. One thing that a lot of people don't know is they are actually altering their flight paths and leaving from the north so that sound is more over the marsh area than anywhere else. But given the density of the area, there's not a lot of options as far as flight paths that can be done.
You mentioned affordable housing. That's a countywide issue. Are there any other countywide issues that you would like to prioritize?
I definitely want to prioritize government accountability in our spending. Taxes have been going up exponentially. Last year alone, between the city, county, and school district, there was $507 in new property taxes. The city of Madison is now proposing $250 or more in property taxes to cover the $27 million shortfall. And the county is going to have to deal with $100 million less because of COVID money going away. So we need to make sure that projects like the zoo enclosure at Vila Zoo, the Dane County Jail, the 911 Center, are being managed properly when it comes to their finances and their construction costs. Construction projects tend to run over on prices, and I think we as county board supervisors need to manage that. And I actually have proposed on my website a specific action I would take to ensure that that is dealt with.
So you mentioned the Dane County Jail and the 911 Dispatch Center. I was curious what your position is on criminal justice reform.
I think that we're making good steps towards criminal justice reform. I fully support the restorative court that is there, and I would continue funding that. I would also propose weekend bail hearings for nonviolent offenders. After my tour of the jail, I learned that people can spend upwards of 4 to 5 days in jail waiting for a bond hearing. In that time frame, people can lose their jobs, which doesn't do anybody any good. It also would save the county some money in housing people who are nonviolent offenders. The other item that I have proposed that was inspired by a gathering that I attended in my district, the opening of Go-O Grocery, was mentioned by Samba Belda, one of the owners, was that communities of color don't have access to capital to start businesses. And I'm proposing initial grant of $1.5 million to help communities of color start businesses, because I believe that economic justice and racial justice go hand in hand. And if we give communities an opportunity to make money and to better their lives, then we should give them that opportunity.
The Dan County Board is slated for a pretty big transition period. So we know that the county executive, Joe Parisi, is retiring very soon. They'll be looking for his replacement. Several seats on the board are either being challenged or folks are not going to run again, including in your own district. So during this time of transition, how do you plan to handle things?
I think that any replacement for an interim county executive needs to be one that shares the values of the people of Dane County. And that does not just mean Madison in general. They need to respect the beliefs and values of people in Dane and in Cottage Grove, Sun Prairie, all the communities of Dane County. So that's something I would look for in an executive. I'd also like to see the new executive, once they're elected in November, have more communication and more meetings with the board so that there's better communication between the board and the executive's office. Because I think over the last few years, there's been a breakdown and animosity has erupted. There's several examples, like with the nomination of Sheila Stubbs to Human Services. That was a breakdown in communication that really got out of hand, I think.
Before I let you go, is there anything else that you'd like to share with our listeners, either about your campaign, your values?
I just want the people of the 12th District to understand that I am their supervisor. I am not beholden to any political ideology or any donors or people endorsing me. I am their supervisor, and that's how I value an elected official. It's how they represent everybody's interest. If anybody cares to find out more about my campaign, they're more than welcome to go to burkefordanecounty.com and just see where I stand on all the major issues. I think that that sets me apart from my opponent. I've been very open about where I stand on issues, and I've been pretty unwavering on all of them.
Thank you again for coming down to speak with me, Sean.
Thank you very much for your time, and thank you to your listeners.
That was Sean Burke, one of two candidates vying for the District 12 seat on the Dane County Board, representing Madison's northeast side. The current supervisor, Larry Palm, is not running for another term. We'll hear from Burke's opponent, Tommy Rylander, later in the week. Burke and Rylander will face off on April 2nd.
And you're listening to Handcrafted Local News here on WORT. Please stay with us. We've got lots more stories coming up.
We hear about a local artist's upbringing across the pond and how that influenced his work. We'll travel back in time to 1969, and of course, every detail about the upcoming weather that you can stand to hear.
But first, we'll take a quick break, check in on some world headlines, and we'll be right back.
The 2024 Wisconsin Film Festival is coming to Madison Thursday, April 4th through Thursday, April 11th. This year's festival boasts over 140 films of all shapes and sizes, including the best cinema has to offer from all over the world and right here in Wisconsin. We've got experimental, animated, and student films, as well as documentaries, restored classics, films for kids, and more. For the first time in years, we'll be returning to both the Bartell Theater and the Barrymore Theater. Plus, we've expanded on the UW campus into Music Hall, and we are heading east to Flick's Brewhouse at the Easttown Mall. The Wisconsin Film Festival curates, promotes, and exhibits programs that showcase the art of cinema. A complete festival guide is available in the March issue of Isthmus and online, and tickets are available at wifilmfest.org. The 2024 Wisconsin Film Festival is coming to a screen near you, Thursday, April 4th through Thursday, April 11th. Helping keep local arts alive for almost 50 years, this is WORT Madison.
With the BBC News, I'm Roisin Hasty. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Türk, has told the BBC that Israel bears significant blame for the humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip. Mr. Volker said that starvation and famine were, as he put it, happening as we speak. He said that if Israel was indeed using starvation as a weapon of war, that would be a crime. The Prime Minister of France, Gabriel Attal, has announced that the state will pursue legal action against a pupil after her headmaster resigns due to death threats following her allegations against him. She claimed that he struck her after she refused to remove her hijab in line with French law. Investigators in the US city of Baltimore are examining the data recorder from the ship that brought down a bridge, killing six people. Divers searching the Patapsco River have recovered the bodies of two of the six missing workers. Argentina has said it's hosting six members of the Venezuelan opposition at its embassy in Caracas. Local media say they are linked to the opposition leader, Maria Corina Machado, who has been banned from running against President Maduro in July's presidential election. Haiti's presidential council has promised to restore public order and democracy in the country. It's expected to be installed in the next few days. The appeals court in Dakar has confirmed that the opposition candidate, Bassirou Diomaye Faye, is the winner of Senegal's presidential election. He secured more than 54% of the vote, well clear of the candidate of the governing party. A French court has reduced the life sentence of a Liberian former rebel, Kouni Camara, to 30 years in prison for his role during Liberia's civil war three decades ago. At his first trial last year, he was found guilty of crimes against humanity and violence against civilians and given a life term, but appealed. BBC News.
And the time is now 6:32, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm your host, Robert McClure, here this evening with my fellow co-host, Marcus Slayton. Thanks for staying with us.
On this week's Framing Culture, feature contributor Jose Teixeira talks with Faisal Abdu'Allah, professor of UW-Madison's art department. Faisal sheds lights on the challenges of British culture and education through the lens of his own experience. He also discusses his ongoing research and creative projects, focusing on dark matter, last year's solo exhibit at the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art.
Framing Culture. Today is our episode number 7, and I have a special guest with me.
Faisal Abdu'Allah.
Faisal is a British artist who, for the last decade, has been living and working in the US, specifically here in Madison, Wisconsin. To start with, I'd like to ask you a little bit about your upbringing. You were born and raised in London, and then the American adventure.
Yes, I was born in London. My parents came to the UK in that Windrush era, around 64. And I was born in 69, I'm the last of eight.
And then when you were a young man, you decided to study arts, or how was that process?
So when I was younger, I was really engaged in drawing at school. And I remember my art teacher, Mr. May, he took me to the National Portrait Gallery. I think I was around 13 or 14. And I remember he let us loose. And as we walked around the National Collection, looking at the paintings in all their glory, it soon dawned on me that all of the images that had subjects that looked like me, they were all in subservient positions. And I thought, that's a little odd. I mean, I'm young. I'm only 13 or 14. So I asked my art teacher, Mr. May, why is it in all of these paintings that when I see myself, they're a servant or they're being impaled? And he went, oh, it's just the artist being the artist. In retrospect, I think he was trying to protect my artistic entry into the art world by saying artists can do that. But it was at that point I wrote myself a promissory note that I would enter into this world of art to just try and move the needle a little and try to have a little bit more of an authentic representation of me and the possibilities.
So you'd say that that was a pivotal moment in which you realized that these ideas and concepts around identity, personal and cultural representation were going to be the key and the essence of your work.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Looking at paintings made me very mindful and image conscious. And knowing of the types of ideas that were being conveyed in these, you know, celebrated pieces, it made me then reevaluate what I was seeing on the newspaper stands, what I was seeing on the news, what I was seeing in film. So painting was a great moment of departure that I began to reevaluate the way in which my body was being represented or misrepresented in popular culture by people that I had no kind of connection with or no authority over. And understanding that it was actually creating a very troubled human being. It was imparting a certain kind of way of thinking that there were no longer any possibilities, that there weren't any kind of joy. There wasn't a variety of the ways in which that I could exist.
And I imagine that, Faisal, at the time you were growing up, in the late 70s and the 80s, under Margaret Thatcher, the UK was not necessarily an easy, welcoming place for Black British communities.
Absolutely. We were coming off the back of this new influx of immigrants from the Caribbean, from the Commonwealth, coming off the back of the race riots. We were the kids of that so-called Windrush generation. So we were trying to navigate education. So that generation that came through the Windrush, they came here in their late 30s. They didn't have to navigate the education system, but their children had to. So we were dealing with school teachers that said, we don't understand you. We were dealing with school teachers that my siblings who were born in Jamaica and they had Jamaican accents were being told that they could not be understood. And therefore, they were put into the classes for children who were deemed to be slow. So you could imagine young kids coming to the UK and being seen as not very intelligent. And then my generation, born and raised in the UK, being almost the subject of the same kind of scrutiny. So it was difficult.
And fast forward to your coming and arrival in the US to be a professor at UW-Madison. You organized at MoMoCA, the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art, last year, a major exhibition, Dark Matter. And so I'd like to dive a little bit into that show. And then if you can talk about the prints, the photos, the installation works that you had there.
Dark Matter was a really important show because I think what it did, it gave the Madison community an opportunity to look at the arc of my practice over the last, I would say, 30 years. And it was curated by Leah Kolb. And what Leah Kolb did, found a kind of line of inquiry that spoke to my spiritual journey, philosophical journey, name change, navigating the UK landscape, my collaboration, and rising from the ashes and being in the United States.
Kudos to Leah Kolb, who is an amazing curator. She's not in Madison anymore. And I want to talk about specifically a super interesting, exciting installation in which the viewer from one side would enter this marvelous red glow, this architectural space, and then would encounter through a path of mirrors this powerful quote. And then when I found myself going the other way around, I discovered a whole space of observing voyeurism that I just found it mesmerizing as an installation piece.
So for me, you know, the piece that I recreated for MoMoCA was a piece that I did in London called The Garden of Eden. And The Garden of Eden was first conceived when I was invited to Austria to do a show by the curator Paolo Bianchi. And I was on this train that was traveling from Vienna to Bregenz. And I remember going through the landscape in the day, and it was a long train journey. And I remember going into each train station and people looking into the carriage. And I was like, they're actually looking at me. And then as it got later into the evening, the carriage becomes reflective. And you can't really see out. You can only see your own reflection. But people have a very good sight of you. And it almost felt like I was in this goldfish bowl. And each time we pulled into the station, the looks became far more explicit. And then when I got to the final destination, it was so dark outside. All I could see as I was going towards the door, these heads going towards my exit. As the door opens, I hear a sound and it's a chanting. I'm like, who's this? And as I listened carefully, I could hear Ku Klux Klan, Ku Klux Klan. And when I look, I see a bunch of skinheads. And I immediately hark back to my early years as a young kid growing up in London and seeing the National Front on the street corners. And they would almost be this image of authority and fear. And as I walk through the group, I remember in Austria, it's going to happen. Someone's going to attack me, but I'm going to take one if I can. And then as soon as I walked through the group, this person said to me, Faisal, and his tall figure stood in front of me. And it was the curator. And he put his arm around me and we walked off. And we got in the car and went to the museum where I was actually staying. And the following morning, I went through the museum and they didn't say anything about what happened the night before. And then I conceived the Garden of Eden in that space. And its first iteration, it was called Eyes Without a Face. They gave me two rooms that were side by side. I asked them to knock a hole in the wall so I'd have a glass that would have a reflective film on it. And there'd be one door, and you could only go into one side if your eyes were blue and the other side if your eyes were brown.
So for Momoka, this is the second iteration of the piece that you decided to present.
I then presented it in London at the Chisholm Gallery, where I collaborated with the architect David Adjaye, and he did this wonderful drawing that would then take up the entire space. And essentially, I said to him that I wanted to build on the Eyes Without a Face exhibition, but create something that was far more immersive. So the piece that was in Momoka was the exact replica of what we had created for the London show in the Chisholm. So for me, the most important thing with the show was that people would come to the exhibition, maybe in a group, and then being divided. And then when they would ask the attendant, why do I have to go this way? Because the artist would like to go this way. And the blue-eyed space, first of all, you have to put on covers on your shoes. And then you walk up a slight ramp, and you go into this brightly lit reflective box. As you step inside this reflective box, it's almost like infinity, because the floor is polished, the ceiling is polished, the glass around you is reflective. And the only thing that you have as a reference is on the floor, there's some text. So people naturally gravitate towards something that they could decode. And as you read it, it's literally the text from Matrix, with Morpheus about the blue pill and the red pill. And all I did was I changed slightly and I replaced some of the language with the garden. So the garden is all around you. And as people are reading the text on the floor, when they finish, they then look up and they're so consumed by themselves, because all they can see is their own reflection. So they're under the impression that this work is a standalone work. And it has a red film on the glass. So it's very warm, almost bodily. When I was a kid, I used to lie on my back in the park and look through my eyelids with my eyes closed. And I always felt that red glow from the inside of my eyelids. And it almost felt the only time that I really felt kind of at peace in isolation. You know, I was in a transcendental space. So when you go on the other side, you are looking in. So the brown-eyed community are always looking into this box, observing. And because this spyglass really breaks up this space of intimacy, it almost tells a story of people's lives, a universal story, that somebody always knows what's going on. They can always see how it plays out. And there's a section of our community who are totally oblivious, or choose to remain ignorant, or choose to just literally just ignore the sound, the noise, and the experiences of other people. And for me, the Garden of Eden was very symbolic of that idea, but also represented that journey in Linz going from night to day.
And I think it is a very successful piece in the sense that the immersive psychological experience and the revelation that happens when you go to the other side, it's quite powerful. Faisal, I wish this was a half an hour interview, but I'm so glad that I interviewed you, and thank you so much.
It's a pleasure, Jose. Thank you.
It's now time for the most comprehensive weather report on the airwaves with WORT's own weather guru, Mr. Rob McClure.
Well, we seem to be back to normal Wisconsin early spring, even if we've just been through something a little more like an Arkansas winter. Our March temperature surplus of 12.5 degrees through the first half of the month has now dwindled to around 6 degrees. And we may yet lose a little more of that before April begins early next week. 38 degrees was our high temperature today. That was 11 degrees below normal. And we'll warm up a little bit as we go into and through the weekend, but cloud cover is going to keep the thermometer somewhat subdued from Friday forward for reasons that I'll go into in a moment. Our winds will come down over the coming couple of days, which will make tomorrow feel a little less harsh than today. That'll be actually before winds finally begin to veer more southeasterly on Friday. The pressure gradient is still pretty tight between the storm that passed us to the west yesterday up the plains, now up over Hudson's Bay, and the incoming Arctic high pressure cell, which has descended southward down the plains and now sits about where the storm was a couple of days ago, over eastern Kansas. The west-east gradient between those two features will slowly ease up tomorrow. That big storm didn't produce any particularly interesting weather here beyond the steady rain, which we certainly needed.
But it was a classic spring storm, a good 1,000 or 1,500 miles in diameter with plenty of energy born of strong temperature contrast, which you expect, of course, this time of year. I invite you to have a look at it, actually, on the water vapor image of the contiguous U.S. that we have linked up on the WORT weather webpage this evening. The storm's energy alone is impressive as it sweeps northward up the plains. And now off to the now that it's off to our north, you might note also, if you're looking at the image, the new pulse of energy that's pressing eastward off the Pacific Ocean along the California-Oregon border. By contrast to the enormous north and south fetches that wrapped into that storm that's just passed us, the energy coming across the continent in the coming few days will be much more zonal in orientation, or west to east, so it'll resegregate cold and warm north and south and produce an accelerated stretch of winds in the process in the upper air from west to east about roughly across the 40th parallel, so that'd be just to the south of Wisconsin. That baroclinic zone will be inclined to produce lift of the warmer and more moist air that's going to gradually begin pooling to its southern side, coming back northward off the Gulf of Mexico after the surface high that's down over Kansas eventually makes its way offshore. The lifting is not going to become organized in any sort of circulation per se, but it will wax and wane in more linear fashion as rather weak waves pass along to the east in the flow over the center of the country from later Saturday on through Monday. So that'll produce a good bit of cloud cover and periodic episodes of rain anyway. We'll see how much rain that ends up putting down. But ahead of that, on Friday, we will have a slightly stronger and more organized circulation coming through as that eastbound jet branch that's approaching the Pacific coast plows over the mountains and lifts a surface reflection. And that little system will pass through Iowa and northern Illinois later Friday into Saturday, producing well, perhaps a tenth of an inch here, maybe two-tenths through the overnight going into Saturday. So nothing like the inch plus that we just saw out of this past storm. I'm hoping we might be able to clear the skies a little bit by later Saturday before this steadier period of cloud cover and sprinkly off and on rains sets up, Sunday going into the early part of next week. But I suggest you dose up on sun tomorrow. In any case, I've got my doubts about how much we'll clear on Saturday. Back to tonight, though, model soundings are indicating fairly steep lapse rates continuing through the overnight period, and along with fairly brisk winds remaining up at 8 to 12 miles per hour, I think the passing cumulus are going to continue, though in even more scattered fashion going through the overnight period, otherwise we'll be clear. Temperatures will drop to the low to mid-20s by dawn. Tomorrow, generally, clear skies should see much less cumulus growth than today, if any. And that should allow temperatures to climb back towards the lower mid-40s on continued westerly winds up at 10 to 15 miles per hour, starting to come down during the later afternoon period and into the evening, down to about 4 to 7 miles per hour during the overnight. Winds will also veer north and northeast overnight, and the high clouds may start to ride in from the southwest as we get on towards Friday morning. Temperatures will drop to the mid-20s. And Friday should see increasing cloud cover, mostly high and mid-level, through the day as winds veer more southeasterly ahead of the incoming low-pressure circulation that will be approaching to our west. Temperatures will reach 50, or perhaps even a little bit better than that, on southeasterly winds, which will increase to 10 to 15 miles per hour. Passing showers may work eastward into the area by late afternoon, but I think they're more likely as we get on into the evening hours and into the overnight, and a tenth or two of precipitation may come down through the overnight period. That should be mostly rain, but our temperatures will be close to freezing that night. Showers will generally be heavier south of Madison and lighter to the north, and the temperatures will hold in the mid to upper 30s on easterly winds at 8 to 12 miles per hour. And Saturday should see the rain scatter east with hopefully some emergence of the sun later on. Temperatures will reach 50 or so on backing north and northwesterly winds up at 10 to 17 miles per hour. And the temperatures will drop into the mid-30s overnight into Sunday with continued mid-level cloud cover. And Sunday may begin to see some passing showers, but otherwise remain cloudy with temperatures in the upper 40s. At the moment, at the station down here on Bedford Street, the temperature is 37 degrees. The dew point is 18. Winds are out of the southwest, 12 miles per hour, still gusting up towards 30 from time to time. Just a few scattered short cumulus up at about 5,000 feet over the station, and the barometer's at 30.03 inches of mercury and rising slowly.
We now go to March 1969 for the successful conclusion of the Black Study Strike, a crackdown on student protesters, and a setback for historic preservation. Stu Levitan has those stories and more from 55 years ago this month on tonight's Madison in the 60s. All these
combined, they melt into a dream.
Madison in the 60s, March 1969. On the 3rd, the UW faculty votes 540 to 414 to create an autonomous, degree-granting Department of Afro-American Studies within the College of Letters and Sciences, the primary demand of the Black People's Alliance during the recent Black Studies strike. The proposal now goes to the Regents and the Coordinating Committee on Higher Education. 800 student housing units could be coming to the far west side as the University Campus Planning Committee approves their construction on the university-owned Ryder Farm on the southeast corner of Whitney Way and Mineral Point Road. If the proposal is accepted by the Coordinating Committee and the legislature, the first 150 units could be ready by fall 1971. Several state senators demand the UW Regents fire American History teaching assistant Ann Gordon for, quote, bad character, because as editor of the underground paper Connections, she published an article by Jim Rowan featuring frequent use of a four-letter obscenity. Influential state senator Fred Risser comes to her defense, and Gordon continues as editor and TA. It's a month of the Empire fighting back. On the 4th, the state Senate, by voice vote, gives final legislative approval to a bill barring students convicted of crimes during university disruptions from receiving state financial aid for 2 years. 2 days later, the Regents hold a special meeting to enact an emergency administrative rule prohibiting students suspended or expelled for illegal acts during demonstrations, or non-students convicted of such acts, from entering any UW campus for a year. The Regents do reject the proposal by Board Vice President James Nellen, team physician for the Green Bay Packers, that all students be fingerprinted. It was in 1966 that the Equal Opportunities Commission said the city should not grant a liquor license to any private club that has racially restrictive membership policies. The council agreed, with enforcement to start, quote, at some future date after 1969. It's now 1969, so the EOC opens an inquiry to see if any of Madison's 14 private clubs with liquor licenses have charters limiting membership to white males. The same three clubs that did in 1966, the Eagles, Elks, and Moose, still do. At least Madison Elks Lodge 410 is trying to change. In late March, more than 250 members vote almost unanimously for a resolution calling on its National Grand Lodge to eliminate the white males provision. The Grand Lodge refuses to do so. And the EOC agrees to draft an ordinance banning bias on the basis of sex. After a presentation by Alder Alicia Ashman and National Organization for Women co-founder Dr. Catherine Clarenbach, the two women from the Near West Side report that several city ordinances discriminate against women, from employment to banking. Even in Madison, Ashman says, unwed mothers employed by the city are ineligible for maternity benefits. It was in 1853 that Abel and Pamela Dunning, the first Europeans to plant crops in Dane County, built the Greek Revival farmhouse they called Mapleside, far out of town on what would become University Avenue. But now its owner, developer Dan Neviser, wants to knock it down and build a gas station and restaurant, much to the outrage of historic preservationists. In March, he offers to donate Mapleside to the Te Chopra Foundation, the group of local preservationists that formed last April, for the foundation to remove. He suggests it could be moved just a few feet to the west for about $70,000. Che Chaparro wants a site in the Arboretum, but is not able to acquire one, putting Mapleside's future in jeopardy. The FBI releases statistics showing that all crimes except auto theft have increased in Madison from 1967 to 68. 2 weeks later, Madison Police Chief Wilbur Emery complains to a joint legislative committee about, quote, a most disturbing lack of enforcement and initiative from the university in curbing campus drug traffic, which he says has forced him to assign drug investigators to campus without being asked. He strongly endorses legislation to have Madison take over law enforcement on campus. The bill passes the Assembly and is set for Senate consideration in January 1970. And students may be bailed out thanks to a fund created by the new Mifflin Street Community Co-op called the Electric Pterodactyl Transit Authority. When the co-op opened on January 13th, it was run by volunteers. But by March, sales are averaging $700 a week, so in addition to the bail fund, full-time staff start to receive a weekly salary of $42. When the city opened the reconstructed University Avenue in November 1966, the entire campus community said having an eastbound lane for buses while the other four lanes went west was dangerous. On March 18th, Circuit Judge Jackman rules it was also illegal for the city to reserve the lane for the exclusive use of the Madison Bus Company, and he dismisses the ticket attorney Ken Herr got for driving there. The city does not appeal, but continues to enforce the ban on private use of the bus lane, much to the disapproval of Circuit Judge Richard Bardwell, who says he will impose, quote, some severe financial penalties if the city issues any more tickets, including for false arrest. The city arrests students in disorderly conduct cases, he notes. How does it expect the students to obey the law when it fails to do so itself? First National Bank officials announced plans to raise and replace their 47-year-old building at the corner of South Pinckney Street and East Washington Avenue and construct a 9-story, multi-million-dollar glass banking complex. Park Superintendent James Marshall, 64, retires after 42 years with the city, 32 as superintendent. There were 350 acres of parkland when Marshall became city forester in 1927. There are now more than 3,000 acres in the system, including the 27 acres on the western shore of Lake Mendota, named in Marshall's honor in 1961. Marshall is succeeded by his former assistant, the aptly named Forrest W. Bradley. And Army Specialist 4th Class Lyle C. Hansbrough, 25. Son of Mrs. Lyle Hansbrough, 4817 Bayfield Terrace, and the late Dr. Hansbrough, is killed in action in Gyadin Province on March 17th. A graduate of West High School and Whitewater State University, he was drafted in February 1968 and has been in country since last July. And that's this week's Madison in the 60s. For your award-winning, listener-supported WORT News Team, I'm Stu Levitan.
And that does it for our show this evening. Thanks for listening to WORT's live local news at 6. Our headline writer this evening was Greg Sanderson. Our reporter was David Ahrens. Special thanks to our feature contributors Mike Mullen from the Wisconsin News Connection, Jose Carlos Teixeira, and Stu Levitan. Katie Giorgella was our on-air engineer this evening, and Faye Parks produced the newscast, and Shelley Pittman is the news director at WORT. I'm your host, Robert McClure.
And I'm your host, Marcus Slayton. Stay up to date with the WORT Local News Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes Podcast, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcast. Up next is Query, followed by This Way Out. Thank you guys for listening, and have a good night.
WORT Madison. final home game of the 2024 Madison Roller Derby season is on Saturday, April 6th in the arena at the Alliant Energy Center. This month's matchups are Reservoir Dolls versus Unholy Rollers and Vixens versus Quad Squad. Doors at 5 p.m., skates hit the track at 6 p.m. Tickets can be purchased online at madisonrollerderby.org/tickets or at the door. The final home game of the 2024 Madison Roller Derby season is on Saturday, April 6th in the arena at the Alliant Energy Center in Madison. Supporting community nonprofits since 1975, this is WORT 89.9 FM Madison, listener-sponsored community radio.
Welcome to Out in the Bay, queer radio and podcast. My guest this week has written an impressive and insightful novel, a memoir really, he tells me, about his boyhood, growing up black and gay in Baltimore in the 1960s. The book, Dancing to the Lyrics, takes us through his sudden uprooting at age four from small town Ohio to one of Baltimore's poorest neighborhoods, where he lives with his young mother, two sisters, and a violent stepfather who's abusive to all of them. It takes us through young Grant and sisters finding dead gunshot victims in their neighborhood, massive riots following the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., and much more. It's grim in many places, yet ultimately inspiring. It takes us to the strength, confidence, and courage this boy finds en route to manhood, even though we only know him in the book from age 4 to 9. Dancing to the Lyrics won its author Dwayne Ratliff a Best Indie Book Award in the LGBTQ Coming of Age category. I'm so glad he sent me this book to read and that he's here to talk with us about it. Dwayne Ratliff, welcome to Out in the Bay.
And thank you for having me. And thank you for reading it.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Dwayne, I'd love it if you could set us up with a short reading from the book. This is when little Grant has arrived in Baltimore after his mother suddenly marries some guy he's never seen before. And all of a sudden, he's got a stepfather who puts him on a plane, takes him to Baltimore, and then a limousine to their new house.
Okay. The chapter is House of Sufferance. The scene outside the window